Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the Conservationists Assemble podcast, the show that seeks to unite Earth's mightiest advocates in a mission to ensure a future for our planet's incredible habitats and its awesome inhabitants. I am your host, Johnny Bloxham, and today's episode is highlighting the world of the polar bear and the awesome work of Polar Bears International. Join the podcast and today's expert guest as we discuss everything about this species and the conservation efforts directed at their survival. This week's expert guest is none other than Amy Cutting, Vice President of Conservation at Polar Bears International. Please welcome Amy as she joins the ranks of the Conservationist Assemble initiative to input her passion, knowledge and expertise on polar bear conservation. Amy, thank you for joining us on the podcast today. How's it going?
Great, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, and I'm very excited to have you here as a representative of such a kind of institutional in-situ conservation program. They don't come much bigger, and so you're here representing Polar Bears International and polar bears as a species. So first place, can you tell us about polar bears?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we'll get into all kinds of things today, I think, but the most important thing to know, polar bears are the world's largest land mammal, which is a little ironic because they're actually categorized as a marine mammal because they receive all their nutrition from that ocean ecosystem and spend most or all of their lives on the frozen surface of the sea ice.
Fantastic. And so they're probably one of the easier animals to talk about, as we're probably going to find out as we go through the podcast, because everyone, if I was a gambling man, I would put money on it that everyone at least has an idea of polar bears. So yeah, it's very unique to have a land mammal considered as a marine mammal. Could you tell us about the role that polar bears have in their ecosystem?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Well, I'm glad you said that. I think people know a lot about polar bears, but not necessarily the nuances, right, of who they are and how they make their living. And so it's a lot of fun to have this long form opportunity to talk about all things polar bears. These guys are the top predator in the Arctic ecosystem. And I think what a lot of people don't think about is there's tons of microscopic life on the underside of the sea ice, right? So you've got those organisms, particularly over the shallow productive waters over the continental shelf, where there's a lot of nutrients in the water. And the nutrients, the energy the algae get from the sun, get concentrated on their way up the food web. They become plankton and then fish and then seals, which is this tremendously high fat resource. And that high fat resource is really the only thing that enables such a huge mammal to survive in these really harsh conditions where food resources are really patchy. And so they've evolved to capitalize on this unique food source. But that's also why they can't just go back to living like brown bears if we lose the sea ice, which is something we hear a lot. And they're just uniquely adapted to that Arctic ecosystem and taking advantage of this particular niche.
So actually then, to build on that, because that's quite an interesting point that you say they can't go back to living like brown bears. Historically, was there ever a time that polar bears were living like brown bears then, or has it always been the niche that they're in now?
Sure. Well, they share a common ancestor, right? So at some point there were likely terrestrial brown bear like animals that separated, and one became what we call the barren ground grizzlies, which are a smaller version of brown bear that live in the subarctic and are actually significantly smaller than most brown bears. And then the other branch discovered, if you will, this high fat resource out on the Arctic ice, and was able to evolve into this large bodied mammal that could survive in those conditions but really requires that high fat resource.
And so then, having that high fat resource, what does that then, if you will, get turned into, or what kind of does that go towards in terms of allowing polar bears to go about their daily routine?
Well, I think what's unique is that they can eat huge amounts at a time and then go for really long periods without eating because of that fat. And the metabolism of fat results not just in energy, but in water. So they can also go a long time without, maybe their whole lives without drinking fresh water. Presumably they're eating snow. But if you think about marine mammals like ice seals, they never drink water. They are metabolizing all of their water from their fat stores. So some pretty crazy metabolic activity going on in these animals.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I've never really thought about, not drinking water, especially when you're talking about animals that are surrounded by it in some way, shape or form. But yeah, I suppose you do have to think that, the water in its liquid form is still full of salt, so they wouldn't do that. And yeah, maybe they will eat snow. That would be quite fun to see. But yeah, I suppose, that makes perfect sense. So in terms of why we're talking about polar bears today, what are they classified as and where are their threats coming from?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the IUCN, the Global Conservation Organization, lists the polar bear as vulnerable. Back in 2008, they were listed as threatened under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. And that was an interesting case because it was the first animal ever listed due to the predicted future loss of their habitat due to sea ice loss in a warming Arctic. They were also listed in 2011 as a species of special concern under the Species at Risk Act in Canada. So that's their domestic legislation to conserve and protect wildlife up there. I think, one of those nuances about polar bears that I was alluding to is there's actually 19 different subpopulations of polar bears, and they live in four different regions of the circumpolar Arctic that we define by how the ice behaves throughout the year, whether it persists or whether it melts away in the summer, whether it sort of piles up from, due to various currents. And so those are really pretty distinct lifestyles for those bears. And each of them will fare differently in a warming Arctic. Some are more immediately at risk and some will be impacted more down the road. But the current warming trends are predicted to lead to a loss of 2/3 of the world's polar bears by the end of the century. And in terms of threats, there are certainly lots of different things that we could be concerned about, but the real threat by several orders of magnitude is this loss of habitat due to climate change. And according to NOAA scientists, the sea ice cover at the end of summer, which is the ice minimum in the Arctic, has shrunk by 13% per decade relative to the 30-year average. And to sort of think about what that means, that's a loss of 31,000 square miles, an area about the size of the state of South Carolina in the U.S., every year. So we're just losing huge landscapes of habitat for these animals. And the other thing that people don't always think about is the ice that survives year round, right? So there is some ice that does not melt away in the Arctic. It's getting thinner and more fragile than it used to be. So that old thick ice used to make up about 1/3 of the Arctic ice pack at the winter maximum back in like 1985. In 2020, in the sea ice maximum, it accounted for less than 5%. So these conditions, make it difficult for a polar bear to make a living. In some places where the ice used to freeze very thick, it might actually be a short-term advantage where you've got these leads and it's opening it up to their prey to move further north. But long-term, they're all going to be impacted. And they're now predicting an ice-free summer even sooner than we had originally thought. Perhaps by the end of the decade, we could see ice-free Arctic in the summer, which is just astounding. And the concern is that the Arctic is, people hear about the warming of the globe, but the Arctic is warming disproportionately. So we're seeing even bigger impacts up north.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it's that do or die time. So really then what, not that there isn't hope, but what do we really need to start doing? Obviously we hear about reducing your carbon footprint, but how are we going to start seeing that measurable change? Or, when could we start seeing that measurable change? Because it's easy, I suppose, to hear that we need to reduce our carbon footprint. I suppose we really need to start hearing the numbers of what reducing the carbon footprint will do in terms of seeing that benefit.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a complicated question for sure. And there's lots of different things happening. In general, if we look at the sort of history of polar bear conservation, back in 1973, there was this meeting of the parties where all polar bear nations agreed to stop the commercial hunting of polar bears. They'd been really decimating them in previous decades. And one of the things you hear now is people talk about, oh, there's more polar bears than there were in the early 70s. And that is absolutely correct because they were being tremendously overhunted, right? So people are comparing apples to oranges. But our polar bear populations right now, most of them are relatively healthy. Some are declining, some might be increasing, and some are holding steady. But we know that our sort of business as usual trajectory on greenhouse gas emissions is going to impact all of them over time if we don't get a handle on it. And so I think you are seeing major progress. You're seeing all this work being done, a lot in Europe, significant amounts in Canada, and we're in US, we're slowly following along. But you're seeing these incentives to clean energy transition and address other greenhouse gases like methane, electrifying our transportation. And it seems disconnected, but that really is truly the best way to protect polar bears. I think it's interesting to focus on the carbon footprint. And just a little aside here, it was the oil companies who invented the concept of the carbon footprint, and they encouraged people to worry about their own personal carbon consumption and carbon footprint as a distraction from the fact that the energy companies would prefer to just keep pumping out fossil fuels and not transition their efforts. And so I think people are waking up to that idea that we need to put pressure back on the people developing our energy options, that we want cleaner options. And we talk a lot at PBI about we need systems change. So of course everyone wants to and should think about living a more sustainable lifestyle, but what we really need is to have more sustainable choices in the products we buy, the corporations we support. And so we are pushing for systems level change, and everyone has a connection and some level of influence in a system, whether it's your community, your school, your apartment building, whatever it is. And if people start taking action at that systems level, we'll start seeing more exponential progress. But we certainly are a climate organization, but we also do work directly with polar bears. So we're working to protect budding polar bear families. We know that stage of life is a really vulnerable time. So we're working to minimize disturbance. And we're also working to keep people and polar bears safe in parts of the Arctic where they're overlapping.
So yeah, what kind of disturbance then, just to build on that, what kind of disturbance would take place in terms of a denning mother?
Well, frankly, you're talking about industry. So we think of these denning areas as being really remote parts of the Arctic, but in some places, those areas have been opened up to industrial activity. And a polar bear mother and family under the snow can't be seen by the naked eye. And so it's really important that we provide the tools to people working in those areas to be able to detect and avoid them. There's good legislation, particularly in the US, to prevent disturbance of bears, but if you don't know they're there, you can't avoid them. So, trying to connect the dots there that we can better utilize our legislation by providing the right tools.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's one thing to not be able to see them if you're on the front lines as an industry, but then that also transcends into, us not even knowing that that would be a threat because you can't even, comprehend it. So that's, yeah, thank
Right.
you for bringing that to light. I do just want to take you back to a bit earlier on when you mentioned about how the kind of the subpopulations are on different forms of ice, etc. And would that mean, would you say kind of polar bears are a very adaptable species if those changes come around in a relatively short amount of generations, for example?
Right. Well, I think the idea of them being adaptable is good. Their ability to evolve is a totally different thing, right? So in the short term, couple of generations, species can't evolve to take advantage of new food sources or change the way they make their living. However, polar bears are incredibly smart. And across the different subpopulations, we do see them preying on different species. We see them using different hunting strategies, right? So they have adapted to capitalize on the resources that are most prevalent in their part of the world. But that doesn't mean, again, that they could find sufficient energy over time to live in that environment if the sea ice melts away.
That's a great point, and I think ultimately I wanted to bring it. I was hoping that that would come up, and just because I remember seeing on Seven Worlds, One Planet by the David Attenborough program. There was one of the episodes was on the ice, well, the North and the South Pole, and there was a particular clip of a lone polar bear taking down a beluga whale. And just like the size difference, B, for it to just to be one individual polar bear, and I'm sure that was a very, very unique situation, and that's obviously not happening. But the fact that they're being forced into that situation, and for that one polar bear, great, and for all of the other polar bears that got to share that prey item afterwards, amazing. But just like, yeah, blew my mind.
Yeah. The strength and power is impressive. When you talk about them pulling an 800-pound animal out of the water, it's pretty stunning. And they have definitely learned to capitalize on carcasses that they come across if animals get trapped in the ice, that sort of thing. But those are not consistent enough forms of nutrition. There are areas off the coast of Alaska where indigenous hunts of whale species continue and the bone piles are left. And there are bears who have discovered those bone piles and learned to utilize that food source. The problem, and so then people ask about supplemental feeding, right? Should we offer them food? And I think the challenge there is, for how long are you going to do that? And what happens if that food source is not available? Are they now going to be coming into communities and that sort of thing? So all of those ideas we hear, while they're people's hearts are definitely in the right place, we've got to think about the long-term future of their habitat. And until we can get a handle on greenhouse gas emissions and start seeing a return of the sea ice, artificially inflating numbers of polar bears in those areas is probably not a great idea.
Yeah, I think it ultimately would lead to some form of human-animal conflict, which, like you've already said, is just one of the many, many roles of Polar Bears International. And that does then bring us onto the platform of Polar Bears International. And yeah, we've briefly talked about the roles, and we'll get onto that a bit later. But could you just give us an idea of how Polar Bears International was founded and how they've got to where they are now?
Absolutely. So PBI was founded actually back in like 1992 by a group of polar bear photographers who had spent time in the area around Churchill, Manitoba, and just really wanted the world to know more about these amazing animals that so few people would ever get to see. But over the years, we've evolved into a crew that I now think of as small but mighty and very nimble conservation organization, and that's bringing needed attention to this existential threat we talk about of climate change. And if I think about you had asked about some of the accomplishments of PBI and what we've done over the years. And just a sort of a short list would be starting with Steve Amstrup, who's our chief scientist emeritus. He led that team that got the polar bear listed under the U.S. Endangered Species Act back in 2008. And recently, he and a colleague who's a climate scientist, Cecilia Bitz, were able to put together a paper connecting specific greenhouse gas emissions emitting projects to specific impacts on species survival of polar bears. And that should require regulation of these projects under the legal language in the Endangered Species Act. It's a major milestone that occurred last year that should remove that loophole for regulating greenhouse gases. So that's a pretty significant career arc for him, and really impressive work. And as I mentioned, for many years, we've been studying polar bear families when they emerge from the maternal dens by placing remote cameras outside of these known dens. And over the decade, the technology continues to improve, and we're building this extensive database of these really rare, direct, detailed observations of the behavior and body condition of families at den emergence. It's another, not only are polar bears difficult to observe directly, getting to actually observe them emerging from their maternal dens is sort of unheard of. So we've also, I think, made a lot of progress on developing new technologies or new applications for technologies. We created we call it a burr on fur tag, which is a tag that can just adhere to the fur of the polar bear rather than having to be on a collar. And that's allowing us to, us and others, to tag and track animals that can't be collared for whatever reason, whether it's males whose necks are too wide or juveniles that we worry about their growth. So that's an exciting tool. And then we've been working with different radar technologies, both to detect the maternal dens, like I mentioned, and also radar to detect polar bears approaching communities in the dark and in harsh Arctic conditions to hopefully provide some early warning systems. And then lastly, since long before the pandemic Zoom revolution, actually since about 2011 or 12, we have been broadcasting live from the tundra into homes and classrooms all over the world. Our Tundra Connections program invites scientists, celebrities, and educators to our mobile studio, Buggy One, provided to us by our partner Frontiers North Adventures. And we show polar bears outside our windows near Churchill, Manitoba, while we share the latest in polar bear research, management, and coexistence. So those are some of our keystone programs and accomplishments that I think make me really proud to be part of this organization.
Yeah, it certainly makes it all-inclusive, which ultimately, I suppose, is the biggest thing you can want from conservation, isn't it, at the end of the day? Because then you get your supporters and you get the funding, and that's actually our next point. So aside from the on-the-ground work and the research that PBI is doing, how and you know where is that funding coming from in order to allow that amazing work to happen?
Yeah, our funding is primarily from individual donors that just support our work and believe in our mission, and we're deeply, deeply grateful for that. I think we have a nice diverse mix of funding support, though. We work with a number of different foundations. There's a significant number of zoos that contribute to our projects and are strong partners of ours. We recently got a Gates Foundation grant, which is very exciting. And of course, corporate sponsors, which I will shamelessly plug now, but Canada Goose in particular and Frontiers North Adventures also have been longstanding significant partners of ours, both supporting our work in the field and providing financial support. And that diversity, just like with your own personal budget, right? Having that diverse stream of resources is really, it gives you some resilience. I will say, though, we've grown substantially over the years from, you know, when I first started volunteering with PBI 20 years ago, there were no employees. And now we have over 30 on several different continents. And our financial demands are quite high. So we're always interested in more people looking to help support our work.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I suppose, you know, again, that inclusiveness by, you know, the cameras, for example, for people to live stream is just almost that incentive to donate because they can see what they're donating to.
Seeing the work in action. Yeah, I would be remiss if I didn't also mention we work closely with Explore.org, who produces the live bear cams from the tundra. So during bear season in the fall, you can actually watch these live cameras that are broadcasting from Tundra Buggy One. And we'll have a new camera out at Cape this year, out at Cape Churchill. And then they also do Northern Lights and Beluga cameras from the community of Churchill. And those are great ways for people to get connected in real time with what's happening up in the Canadian North.
I know they've certainly got one more person watching after we've finished recording today. It sounds right up my street. And so kind of you mentioned that community of zoos, and I believe having a look at the website, it's about 50 zoos globally, which is fantastic that it's a global effort. So what is the method of getting zoos on board, and what does having that zoo community, you know, provide?
It's a great question. Yeah, we are actually celebrating the 20th anniversary of our Arctic Ambassador Center network this year. So we've been working with zoos for, you know, two decades. And there's, as you mentioned, there's over 50 right now zoos and aquariums in North America and Europe that have signed, you know, agreements with us to become Arctic Ambassador Centers. And these partner, you know, zoos are hosting hundreds of millions of visitors each year. And these people are coming from all walks of life. It's different from a national park or wildlife refuge. You know, all kinds of people come to the zoo. And so zoos and aquariums are uniquely positioned to engage with the public about the need to address climate change, to conserve all kinds of wildlife. And zoos have also been active over the last decade or so in contributing to scientific research that helps us better understand wild polar bears. Some of these projects are getting at the heart of energetics questions or calibrating new tracking technologies in ways that just could not happen with free-ranging wild bears in harsh, remote, you know, Arctic areas. And when I was at the Oregon Zoo, we engaged in several of these projects, and it was really rewarding. You know, the animals actually participate in these fun training sessions. You know, we do a lot of voluntary training to encourage their participation. They work with their caregivers. the staff get this opportunity to directly connect to conservation, and our zoo guests get to see science in action, which is, you know, another mission is sort of scientific literacy in the community. So our relationships with zoos are both deep and broad. We have a what we call a climate alliance program every year, where we solicit our member organizations can put forward participants to join in this training season, and they spend time working virtually on their climate communication and the depth of their polar bear knowledge, and then they come with us up to Churchill and engage in training and exposure to what it looks like to be up in the north in these communities, and they return to their institutions to train their teams on how to reach out about polar bears and climate and the urgent need for action. And we've trained hundreds of people at this point at multiple different institutions. So we're really, I think, leveraging those partners to get the word out in a way that we know is effective and impactful. And then we also know that those teams are getting something from the experience in terms of networking with their colleagues, feeling like they're part of a larger purpose. And it's a really inspiring collaboration that we have going.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. And it sounds like the perfect program to, you know, develop a passion in someone that, of course, when they go back to their job, they're literally going to tell anyone and everyone that they can get their hands on to listen about it. So yeah, it sounds like a really good initiative.
Well, and zoos have impressive social media reach these days too. So it's not just about their on grounds programming. They have clever, witty, fun, beautiful social media channels that people are following. And it gives them an opportunity to speak to a really big number of people about conservation actions that they can be taking. And a colleague of mine at Oregon Zoo likes to call it chocolate wrapped vitamins, you know, that you tune into the social channel to see the cute picture of an otter that day, and then you learn about some legislation you should be supporting.
Yeah, it's a real kind of great mix of both. And speaking of the education that zoos are doing and PBI in general, are there any big kind of events coming up that people should be tuning in for?
There always are big events coming up that people should be tuning in for. Yeah, we just wrapped up our annual International Polar Bear Day, which is February 27th every year. And we celebrate that day and talk about our work with moms and cubs. And our Arctic Ambassador Center Network and other friends and partners push that message out, and it ends up quite a bit in the popular media nowadays. So that's a big one that we're very proud of and has become a real attention grabber. In the summer, in July, we celebrate Arctic Sea Ice Day, July 15th, which is typically the sea ice minimum in the Arctic. And that's an opportunity for us to talk about what polar bears are doing over the summer. And many of them are forced ashore during that time. But it's time to celebrate the Arctic ecosystem as the Earth's air conditioner, and thinking about how we protect that resource for all of us. And then, of course, Polar Bear Week is typically the first week in November. It often is kind of straddles Halloween. And that is the week when polar bears, typically the largest number of the season, are moving through the area around Churchill towards the mouth of the Churchill River, where the sea ice freezes first in Hudson Bay. And so Polar Bear Week is a great time to tune into the polar bear cameras and to our Tundra Connections broadcast. It's just a time to celebrate the bears getting back out on the ice for the season of feeding.
Fantastic. A few dates there for our listeners to put in their calendars. Again, I'll be putting them in mine and yeah, tuning into all of them. And so, Amy, that's given us a great insight into polar bears, the work of PBI, and what everyone can do to participate. So we're going to switch track now and kind of highlight your career and how you got to where you are. I'm very excited to have you on, as we mentioned earlier. But yeah, so tell us about yourself and give us an insight into your background and how you got to PBI.
Absolutely. So I think, like many young people who was interested in biology, I thought, oh, I'll be a biology teacher. I came from a long line of not scientists. And so honestly had no idea what the different options might be. So it seemed like what you did if you loved the science of life was become a teacher and tell other people all about it. But somewhere in there, I went on a whale watch excursion and decided that was what I wanted to do with my life, is study whales. And as often happens, you know, serendipity and different kinds of things. And I ended up at a dolphin lab at the University of Hawaii that was studying memory and cognition and language. But during the period of getting my master's at that lab, what I realized is I really loved working with the animals and working with the people learning to train the animals. That was really satisfying for me, not so much the research and writing part. So I volunteered at the local zoo, and I fell in love with that and ended up following that path. So most recently, I was a curator at the Oregon Zoo. I was actually at Oregon for 20 years, and I was involved with PBI all of that time. I worked closely with them since about 2004, facilitating meetings, helping with workshops, that sort of thing as a volunteer. But the last couple of years I was at Oregon, we had these incredible opportunities to facilitate these conservation science studies. And the keepers, you know, trained a polar bear to walk on a treadmill, and they taught her to swim in a swim flume so we could gather information about energetics and calorie consumption and activity. They taught them to give voluntary blood samples and allowed us to calibrate a bunch of different techniques for studying animals in the field. And it was really extremely satisfying to bring those two parts of my career together. And then I got the opportunity to join Polar Bears International in this new position as their vice president of conservation. And honestly, I like to tell people I feel like the groupie that got to join the band. So it's really been a privilege, you know, to join this team and explore what we can do with all the talent that we have.
Yeah, some of that research sounds insane, like just being able to do that and the long-term benefits that it's going to have is phenomenal. And so obviously we're here talking about polar bears. So is there a particular individual polar bear that's had a particular attachment or impact on your career or a completely different species?
Right. Oh gosh. Honestly, there's so many. And they're definitely not all polar bears. You know, almost every animal you work with becomes special to you in a different way. I was lucky enough early in my career, I worked with a female that had given birth to cubs at the Seneca Park Zoo in Rochester. And I'll probably never forget, she'd been cooped up with them, right, for 8 weeks or whatever it is before they can really be mobile, and was clearly getting a little tired of their company. And I'll never forget one day she sort of pushed him up against the fence in front of me and stared at me and ran outside to go for a swim. And, you know, I was like, she just asked me to babysit.
Yeah.
And I was really moved by the level of trust that she had to sort of leave them behind with me to take a break. But I think, you know, there's one bear at the Oregon Zoo that will always be special to me. Her name is Tossel. And she was the first bear in the world to give a voluntary blood sample, right? The keepers just trained her and made her comfortable and rewarded her to the point that she would allow them to take a blood sample. And the trust that she developed with her keepers and her curiosity about all the odd things we were asking her to do, you know, she was always intrigued by, well, what are they coming up with now? And what are they asking me to do now? And she was always very interested in it. And, you know, she was an animal who had not had a great early experience in the zoo environment. She was 20 when I met her, and that was 15 years ago. And it just super cool to see her flourish under the modern care, mm-hmm. And the, you know, stunningly capable keepers that we had. And that's, you know, a real theme of my career, I think, is watching the zoo community evolve into something we can really be proud of.
Yeah, definitely. I think polar bears are certainly one of the kind of species that you can have that clear cut definition of the improvement of standards of them within zoo care. There's always books of polar bears in zoos back then, and to see the level of difference now is so kind of moving and fulfilling for where the zoo industry is going.
Absolutely.
So what does a typical day look like for you as vice chair for conservation?
Well, I would say these days I get a lot less exercise than I used to. I used to put in several miles a day walking around the zoo, as zoo staff do. And these days I'm a bit of a desk jockey, working from home when I'm not traveling. The zoo does actually provide me some desk space, so I sometimes pop in up at the Oregon Zoo and get to get out of my house. And but I have a lot of meetings, honestly, with the program teams, our media folks, our science team, one-on-ones with staff. And I also get to do a fair amount of writing. They let me do first drafts. We have actual professionals who always check my work. But so in many ways, it is a desk job. But then, of course, on average, about once a month, I do get to travel. And that's not always super glamorous things, to like going to see polar bears in the wild. It might be going to visit some of our zoo partners who always host us so well, and it's always a delight to go and meet with folks. It might be meeting with sponsors, it might be escorting people up to see polar bears, it could be traveling to see some of my remote coworkers who are kind of all over the place. So it's a nice blend between traveling and getting to work from home and have some flexibility in my schedule and engage remotely with people all over the world.
Yeah, and that's a really nice point. So on that, what do you feel like this level of networking is has done for you?
Oh gosh. I think it's very eye-opening and provides a lot of perspective to talk with people who are all over the world. We have people in Ohio and Missouri and Norway and Churchill, Manitoba and Scotland. And so it's always good to hear what's happening in other parts of the world. It helps break down that sort of US-centric worldview that a lot of us are guilty of. And I always find it super inspiring too. When I was in the zoo field, often people would get to travel maybe once a year, every other year, to go to a conference or a workshop and come home just incredibly inspired and motivated. And that tends to, peter out over time. And so the ability to constantly be recharging my batteries by being around really energized, motivated people is just a gift.
That's great. And so then would you say, because obviously you say you didn't come from a long line of biology support studies, would you say it's those people that have motivated you then, or what were who were your influences in your career?
There were a number of people over the years that believed in me and my abilities before I had a title to go with it. So I mentioned, working with PBI and volunteering with them since 2004. I was an animal keeper for the first 10 years of that, and I loved my job. But of course, I was also looking for ways to have a broader impact. And Polar Bears International folks always included me and asked me to help and support. So I got the opportunity to facilitate some, meetings with a lot of important people from various walks of life. I got the opportunity to meet some of the world's most prominent polar bear biologists, have one-on-one conversations with them. And I think all of that helped me build the skills and abilities that I have now. And I just think I would really encourage people to look for leader opportunities, regardless of your official title, and encourage people who are already in a leadership role to look for those who show promise and encourage and support them. I think sometimes we wait around for people to be in the right role or have the right title, and people can take on leadership roles to make impacts regardless of where they are in the organization if we give them the opportunity.
Right, some very valid advice, and yeah, it's great to hear about what PBI did for you, and obviously now how you're giving back as a collaborative effort with PBI and all of the other partners. So that's yeah, really kind of full circle, and just lovely to hear. So, is there anything else that you'd like to achieve in your career?
Anything else I'd like to achieve? A wise person once told me that our primary job is to find, hire, and train our replacement. And I'm surrounded by talent at PBI, so I'm really excited to spend the latter part of my career, helping them grow as conservation leaders, while we're continually striving for significant climate action. Conservation doesn't have an end point. I don't think we're ever going to arrive. So, but I do hope that I do hope that by the time I'm ready to retire, this beginning of an exponential curve that I see toward a more sustainable future really starts to zip up, you know, and take on a trajectory that's going to get us there in a timely fashion. I'm encouraged. I think human progress is exponential. And so it's all about momentum. And we're finally starting to see that momentum. And I'm really optimistic that if people continue to speak up and step up, that we're going to get there in time to preserve a future for polar bears.
And what advice, not that you're giving up your boots just yet, but what advice would you give to someone looking to move into leadership roles?
Yeah, interesting. I think, you know, be ready to do the hard work too. A lot of people get into conservation or just animal work in general because it's super fun and there's a lot of fun and excitement and passion, but it can also be a bit of a grind, right? So you have to bring your grit and your perseverance. There's a reason they pay you.
Yeah.
It is a job. And you know, I know wildlife biologists who never really see their target animal, just their photos or their hair or their poop, right? So you definitely have to keep that big picture in mind and know that it takes hard work to make a difference. And then, you know, I have kids myself now, and they're thinking about what they want to do with their life. And the advice I always give is to really think hard about what kinds of things you actually want to do all day, not just what title or position you want to have, but what does that work look like day to day? Because careers are long, and, you know, you can go into something for the passion and the motivation. But if you don't enjoy it on a day to day basis, if you're not doing the activities that you really love, you're going to need to look to make a change. Which
yeah,
is also fine.
Very poignant. And on the note of the daily grind, we're now going to shift focus to how you unwind and how you step away, because it is, like you say, hard work, long hours, it's never done, but that work-life balance is incredibly important. So, Amy, thank you for giving us an insight into your background. And yeah, we just want to learn about what you do to relax. So, or, you know, aside from that, what else makes you tick? We've talked about, you know, the animals and individuals that you've enjoyed working with. Are there any animals that you'd love to see in the wild?
Oh yeah. You know, narwhal is sort of a holy grail for me. Maybe I'll get the opportunity, but you know, they've, for so many years when I was younger, I thought they were like unicorns and they were mythical. And then found out that they were real and thought, oh boy, I got to see that. And then there's just some interesting places I'd love to travel someday. And I don't know that I'll have any reason to anytime soon, but Indonesia has always fascinated with me with all the sort of unique bird and reptile species they have there. I think I'm going to get to see belugas this summer. There's a pretty big population in the Churchill River in the summer months. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, holding out hope that you definitely get to see belugas and hopefully narwhals one day. That would be insane,
right?
And yeah, definitely could get on board with getting out to Southeast Asia as well. They've got such a range of biodiversity. And if you could be an animal, what would you be and why?
Oh geez, well I can't say polar bear because I don't actually do that well in the cold. If I'm being honest, sometimes I think I should have done tropical birds international, but. If I had to choose, I would probably say a tamarin. And I'm not sure if everyone knows a tamarin, a tiny little primate. And it's just the closest thing I can think of is the cross between a primate and a bird. I've always thought it'd be cool to fly, but I wouldn't want to be not so smart. And tamarins are just, you know, they're smart, they're busy, incredibly athletic, which of course is more and more appealing the older I get. But yeah, they're just fun little critters. I think it'd be a joy.
Yeah, certainly full of character. When you're not working, Amy, how do you keep busy?
Oh, these days, mostly raising kids. I have two daughters, 14 and 17, and, you know, they're kind of starting to raise themselves, which is nice. But I also love hiking. I live in Portland, Oregon, spend a lot of time out in the Pacific Northwest. Finding swimming holes with my kids is fun in the summer. I love to visit the Oregon coast. The water's cold. You can't really swim, but it's absolutely stunning place to be. My dogs love it there too. And then honestly, I'm big on low-key stuff like reading and crossword puzzles. I'm a bit of a homebody.
Yeah, talk to us more about Oregon. So it's northwest states.
Yep.
Between
yep.
California
sandwiched
and
between
Seattle.
Yeah. Washington north of us, and California south of us. Yeah.
What's the terrain like? Because it's obviously when you've got California to the south, and obviously we know how much wildlife is in California, but I think your mm-hmm. first kind of thought process of California is that it's very modern and Western now. What's going on in Oregon?
Oregon is an awesome blend of sort of urban and rural and wild spaces. And Portland, where I live in particular, has a real commitment to green space. And so it is very green. You can drive 20 minutes in any direction and get to open space. We have the largest city park in the country, Forest Park here in Portland. It's an hour to the mountains, an hour to the coast. It's just a fantastic place to raise kids, honestly. If you head east of the mountains, so the Cascades runs through the western third, along the line of the western third of the state, the central and eastern Oregon is actually quite dry. So if you want to, it's considered high desert. So there's just a lot of ecological diversity in the state. And I think people really value nature and the outdoors. So it's a great place to live.
Yeah, sounds like a really
I will say our weather is pretty similar to the UK. I had the opportunity to be in Yorkshire not long ago. The Yorkshire Wildlife Park hosted a polar bear workshop for zoo colleagues in YASA and the European Association. It was great to be up there. But yeah, cool and wet is kind of what we do.
And I suppose then, you know, two things to finish up on. How can our listeners keep up to date with the work of PBR?
Great question. Yeah, we have lots of ways to do that. But the main way would be to go to our website, which is just polarbearsinternational.org. And they have a one question questionnaire where you can identify with what kind of persona you would like to receive information regarding. So you can sign up as a conservationist or an educator or an animal lover. And that will help tailor the email updates that you receive, which I think is a really nice thing. We all have full inboxes and we want to have information coming to us that's most aligned with what we're interested in. So yeah, go to polarbearsinternational.org and sign up to receive our communications and we'll keep you posted. Of course, we're also active on, you know, Facebook and Insta and all of the things that those young people are doing these days.
I've never really thought about tailoring the kind of content that's being put out, but that sounds like a really kind of modern and inclusive initiative.
Yeah, it's a new effort of ours, and I think we just recognize that people are coming to PBI for all kinds of different reasons, and we want to make sure that we're not peppering them with content that's not of interest. So we're trying to really identify who we're talking to and make sure that what shows up in their inbox is of interest.
Yeah, that's really fantastic. And last thing then is what do you think, or is there one thing that you really think our listeners should take away from today's episode?
Yeah, I honestly think the most important thing is just to remember that we all have a role to play with polar bears. They might be very far away, but because the major threat to them is climate, you know, we all have the ability to move the needle on climate. We all have some sort of system, whether it's a community, a school, or a business that we can influence. And of course, we can all vote for leaders who prioritize climate action and then hold them accountable for that. It's our future. It's our kids' future. And now is the time.
Yeah, a great point to finish up on there. So, Amy, a massive shout out to you for giving your time and joining the podcast today. It's been really, really cool to listen to you talk about all things polar bear and how inclusive the conservation can be. So we will be sure to keep up to date with PBI, so I'll be adding everything to the calendar that I possibly can to be available on those dates. We'll be sure to keep up with any polar bear developments. So yeah, truly thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate being invited. I happen to like talking about polar bears quite a bit.
It's always beneficial when you like talking about the work that you do. I'm sad to say it, folks, but that is all we have for this week's episode of the Conservationist Assemble podcast. A massive thank you to Amy for her hard work in conservation and her time on the podcast today, but also a huge thank you to all of you for tuning in as always. If you did enjoy this episode, please like, share and review or rate the podcast, as it helps us to keep improving and spreading the word on the conservation efforts taking place around the world. Don't forget that you can always follow and interact with the podcast on Instagram, Facebook, or via email. I've been your host, Johnny Bloxham, and I hope to see you all next time. This week's thought to remember is, you are not Atlas carrying the world on your shoulder. It is good to remember that the planet is carrying you.